You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS, hosted by Med Learning Group. This podcast is the second of two podcasts in this series geared towards hematologists and other caregivers who treat this condition. In this podcast, Dr. Daniel D'Angelo will discuss treatment options and prognosis for MDS. My name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. So I'd like to welcome back Dr. D'Angelo, who's joining us today. Dr. D'Angelo is chief of the Division of Leukemia at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and he's also a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He has researched and spoken at length about myelodysplastic syndrome and has been involved with many educational programs on MDS and other hematologic conditions for several years. Thank you for being here with us, Dr. D'Angelo.
Oh, thanks, Chris. It's really a pleasure to participate in this podcast.
Well, thank you. In our last podcast, we talked about identification and diagnosis. This one will be geared a little bit more towards treatments for MDS, so let's start right there. So after a diagnosis is made, what are some of the first things you tell your patients about the treatments that they can expect?
First of all, the diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome, as we alluded to last time, is a little simple. I mean, you either have myelodysplasia based on the bone marrow morphology or not, but what's important is the prognosis and putting patients into what I call different buckets. A lot of times patients are told that myelodysplastic syndrome is a form of pre-leukemia. I really don't like that. Pre-leukemia implies that everybody's going to develop leukemia, but in fact, there are patients who are at high risk of developing leukemia, and there are patients at low risk of developing leukemia, and of course, there's the middle. And what I'd like to explain to patients is what bucket they're in, because I think it's very important. Patients with high risk group, the high risk patients with myelodysplastic syndrome have a very high risk and therefore, if left untreated, limited survival versus the low risk patients, which can have a very extensive survival and treatment there is to improve counts, improve symptoms. But the risk of going to leukemia in the low risk group is very low, not zero, is very low, and things can change with time. That's why continuous reassessment is important. But at least that's what I try to impress upon my patients. Unfortunately, patients are often on the computer and they'll look at their numbers and what's associated with these risk groups are median survivals. But I remind them that that is historic. These survivals were for patients that were historically not treated for their MDS, and we looked at the natural history. Of course, in 2023, that's very different, so I encourage them not to look at that. So that's the first thing I do. We have a diagnosis. I try to put them in the different risk groups and try to explain to them what that means.
So for low-risk MDS, what are the current approaches we have for treatment, and what are some of the experimental avenues that researchers are looking at these days?
So the first thing in a patient with low-risk MDS, again, is these are patients who have a low risk of converting to acute myeloid leukemia, right? Risk of what? And so that I try to establish that. And then you try to set up the problem. So there are patients with low-risk myelodysplastic syndrome who have clinically not significant blood counts. So their counts are low, but they're not having any issues. And those are patients we just observe. But there are patients who you want to improve, you want to support. And these are patients typically, not always, but typically who have cytopenias of clinical relevance. So these are patients who are anemic to the point that they're requiring transfusions, and or they have low platelets or thrombocytopenic to the point that they're either having bleeding, bruising, or complications, or they're neutropenic, they have a low white count and neutrophil count, and they're having recurrent infections. And the approach to each of those may be a little different. The most common is anemia. And again, then you have to assess the patient, right? You don't want to make a patient a patient, though. You have a patient who, and you don't want to make sure by your therapy now that they're going to have to see more of you than they need. And so if your patient, for example, is requiring a blood transfusion every 3 to 4 months, I'd probably just leave them alone. But if they're starting to require blood transfusions every few weeks, well, then we can start doing something because I think that's important. Patients with chronic transfusions start getting liver issues and cardiac issues due to iron overload. And so it's important to try and minimize that. And the first thing is growth factors. Erythropoietin stimulating agents, there's many of them, is the first ploy that one can use. It's important to measure a hormone called erythropoietin. if that erythropoietin level is, it's usually elevated, but if it's very elevated above 500, for example, patients are not going to respond to erythropoietin stimulating agents. If it's below that, then I'll usually give a try. It works about 30 to 40% of the time. If that's not available, or if that doesn't work, then there's alternative strategies that have been developed. Luspatercept is approved for patients with ring sideroblasts, likely be approved for other patients. And that's another option. Lenalidomide, approved in patients with deletion of 5q, that's specific cytogenetic abnormality in patients with low risk MDS, can improve. But it can also improve in patients without the deletion 5q, although response rates in that group are a little bit less robust. All of these are palliative. All of these have a time dependent approach. That is, they can help patients improve their transfusion requirements, hopefully ameliorate them, but eventually they stop working and we're left with alternative strategies like, you know, either chemotherapy approaches, and in some younger patients, maybe even transplant.
So backing up to blood transfusions, what exactly are you looking for with these transfusions? I know there's the potential for dependence on them. Are they a long-term solution for anyone, or does everyone eventually progress to these other therapies?
That's a great point, Chris. You know, the only known cure for myelodysplastic syndrome is stem cell transplantation. So all other therapies, whether they're supportive with erythropoietin stimulating agents, luspatercept, lenalidomide, or low-dose chemotherapy like azacitidine or decitabine, those are all palliative. They're time-limited. The potential for cure is with stem cell transplantation. We typically reserve that for high-risk patients because of the risk of transplant, and not for low-risk patients because the time to transform to acute leukemia may be several years, and that assumption of risk of transplant just doesn't make sense unless a patient is starting to progress. Progress towards high risk, progress towards leukemia, or progress in the terms of requiring many, many more transfusions, or having more cytopenias, or having more infections, so on and so forth. So patients who are at higher risk, no matter how you define it, are patients that we usually will expose to the risk of transplant. And so for low risk patients, we usually take a pause and see how things play out. But you're absolutely right. All of these modalities, if you will, are palliative in nature.
So at this time, there's a small handful of targeted therapies, lenalidomide, luspatercept, as you mentioned briefly before. Go into a little bit more detail about these. What are these and how are they used for specific MDS circumstances?
So lenalidomide is a very novel approach. I mean, it's a drug that was, you know, derived from thalidomide, which has an interesting history. It is associated with, you know, abnormalities with birth and in terms of that. So it's very restricted. There's a lot of requirements that one has to go to. It's a standard of care for patients with myeloma. But in patients with myelodysplastic syndrome, there's two large groups of patients, specifically the patients who have this deletion of 5q, that's chromosome 5. And there's a specific place on the fifth chromosome, this Q31 through 35 area. And there's a gene that's not there because it's been deleted. And that lenalidomide, it can inhibit the other side, the other one that's not deleted. And what happens for these patients is that the MDS cells are actually killed. And patients then have recurrence of their normal hematopoiesis, their normal blood potential. And some patients not only improve their blood counts, but can go into a remission. That can last several years. So there's this deletion 5Q, and lenalidomide is the standard for patients who are, not all patients, but patients who are red blood cell transfusion dependent and have stopped responding or did not respond to an erythropoietin stimulating agent. So very important. But it also has effect, and I think we're still learning on how that works, effects on the deletion, on the non-DEL 5Q MDS. That the response rates are not so robust, but about 25% of patients without deletion of 5Q can improve their red blood cell counts to the point that they're no longer requiring transfusions. The other, you know, semi-targeted therapy or target therapy would be luspatercept. Luspatercept has this like anti-inflammatory, it binds this activin, which is part of the TGF-beta family. And what that protein does is it suppresses red cell production, and by blocking it, you de-repress or you allow patients' red blood cells to now grow. It seems to work best in patients with another subtype of MDS called ring sideroblasts. These patients, the ring sideroblasts, when you look under the microscope, again, back to the diagnosis, you're looking for the red cell, the early red cells. And when you do an iron stain, there's little dots of iron around the nucleus. It's literally ringing the nucleus. And so these sideroblasts, these early red cell precursors, have these little rings. They're absolutely beautiful if you're interested in pathology. And that subclass seems to respond best to luspatercept. And this is an injection every 3 weeks. And again, about 40 to 50% of patients can become transfusion independent for about a year or so. I've had patients who have been transfusion independent. Again, that's anecdotes, but for many years, but you know, average is average. And so these are targeted therapies. Another targeted therapy that's not yet FDA approved, but had a positive presentation at a recent meeting at ASCO is imetelstat. Imetelstat is an inhibitor of a enzyme called telomerase. Telomerase adjusts the ends of the DNA. So again, a very specific role. How this specifically improves red cell production is unclear, but imetelstat was tested in patients with myelodysplastic syndrome who were red blood cell transfusion dependent and had stopped responding to erythropoietin stimulating agents or were unlikely to respond because their EPO level is too high. And there was a huge benefit in terms of becoming transfusion independent to red cells for a long period of time. So again, we're waiting for that approval from the FDA.
Well, that sounds pretty promising. We've got definitely have some targeted agents with, you know, another one or two on the horizon for specific types of MDS, it sounds like. But let's finish with a few final thoughts. So for our listeners, what's the path forward with these and some of the newer agents coming out? In your opinion, have we made good progress in the fight against MDS?
You know, MDS, there's a lot more strategies now for MDS. And I think that, you know, the less is best approach, trying to minimize transfusions with erythropoietin stimulating agents, luspatercept, imetelstat, hopefully soon, are strategies that are very important. Lenalidomide and you know, both the deletion 5Q as well as the non-DEL 5Q. So we have a few tools in the toolbox. When those agents fail or patients progress on them, then, you know, the back to basics, the low-dose chemotherapy with azacitidine or decitabine, or even the oral decitabine cetazuridine that was recently approved. These are still reasonable agents for the right patient to try and improve their blood counts. And there are studies showing that fewer days, for example, azacitidine instead of the standard 7 days, 5 days may be as effective in low-risk MDS. And the same thing for decitabine, maybe 3 days as opposed to 5 days. But these approaches can also help improve the blood counts. We usually reserve those for when the targeted agents, the supportive care agents, if you will, have stopped working or failed. And then if patients are still, younger patients, that is, are still transfusion dependent or having recurrent infections or having issues with very low platelet counts requiring transfusions, those are patients who are candidates for stem cell transplantation, which is the only known curative strategy for MDS. So now there's many, many more strategies. Again, prognostication based on cytogenetics, bone marrow morphology, and very important molecular mutations is now the standard of care for establishing a diagnosis and then impacting therapeutic strategies for our patients with MDS.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. D'Angelo. This has been a great discussion of the treatments for MDS and how they're used on an individualized basis in practice. But that's it for now. Once again, thank you, Dr. D'Angelo, for joining us, and thanks to all of our listeners for joining us as well. As a reminder, this is the second of two podcasts on MDS, so I invite you to listen to the first, in which we discussed identification and diagnosis of MDS. Also, MedLearning Group offers many types of CME programs across a variety of disease states, including several hematology topics. So I invite you to explore these on our website, medlearninggroup.com. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Bristol-Myers Squibb, who provided unrestricted grants for this educational activity. Thank you very much and have a great day.